Hello and welcome to the Global Energy Transition Podcast, presented by the Heinrich Böll Stiftung European Union and the Global Energy Transition Blog. I am your host, Michael Buxbaum, lead blogger, photojournalist, and advisor to the energytransition.org. Though I am based in Germany, our podcast series reviews how the energy transition is developing globally while we discuss proposed solutions to the growing climate emergency. Like the blogs we publish, all our materials fall under a Creative Commons license and are therefore free for anyone to use so long as you credit the material. As the climate crisis envelops us, we intend for this podcast series to inform listeners about other additional tools being developed to deal with what's ahead. Though we all may not be in the same boats, we all face the same gathering storm. We recorded this podcast between the years, as they say here in Germany, and we wanted to start the new year off by sending you some good news and positivity for a change. A question that haunts many of us is, how are we going to realize our necessary clean energy transition? Thankfully, there are lots of answers at hand today, and for this show, we're going to talk about several of them. As you know, the transformational change we need requires action on all fronts. Technological, philosophical, financial, societal, political, both on high in national capitals and in your hometown. Starting off this new year, we're going to provide you with a fantastic update to a strategy that we covered in our first podcast, the adoption of a fossil fuels non-proliferation treaty. And then we're going to dive into a host of other solutions by picking the big brain of Dolph Gehlen, the director of the International Renewable Energy Agency's Technology and Innovation Center, sited here in Bonn, about a kilometer from where we're recording. Stay tuned. Listeners, this is going to be something of a bonny show because our little city on the Rhine River is also home to one of the world's biggest proponents of clean energy. But before we check in with Dolph at Arena, we're going to celebrate a little bit because late last year, Bonn became the first German city and the second city in the EU to adopt the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty. Thank you. Always good to hear from our studio audience. Yes. And now I know what you are thinking. Yes, it is possible that since we taped this show in Bonn and Bonn adopted the treaty, then this grand achievement is due to our listeners. But I'm not entirely convinced. To help us clear up this mystery, I have one of the treaty's international organizers joining the pod. Aloha! Before we start, could you tell the audience your name and your role in the Fossil Fuels Treaty campaign?
My name is Sebla Samuel, and I'm the Global Cities Lead for the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Could you tell us what's so important about Bonn's endorsement of the Fossil Fuels Non-Proliferation Treaty?
Yeah, we were super excited with the Bonn endorsement last week. I think it's incredibly important as the headquarters of the UNFCCC, or the UN Climate Secretariat. As the headquarters and as also the space of the Bonn Intersessionals, it's a really key city in terms of global climate negotiations. And so for the city to kind of take extra action and step up the need for fossil fuel phase out is incredibly important. And I think it's also showing kind of the need to have complementary international cooperation on fossil fuel phase out and not solely on reducing emissions and reducing demand for fossil fuels. So we're hoping that this can kind of excite many other cities. And we're already seeing different German cities kind of approaching us and saying, how can our city be part of this? So we want it to be a multiplier effect. And also, it's the seat of the ICLE Secretariat, apparently, I didn't know, which is another kind of network of climate and cities. I hadn't realized that was the headquarters. So we're hoping this will just continue the momentum, but it's great to see recognition from the seat of the UN climate headquarters.
Now, I should say that I'm calling you from the still federal city of Bonn. I'm a proud Bonnerite. Never been prouder. Several fun facts about Bonn. We were West Germany's federal capital from 1949-1990 when the federal seat moved to Berlin. However, there's still today a big federal presence here, and all the federal ministries still have some sort of a ministry or a building or whatnot. And although many of the key federal buildings, like the former West German Parliament, are now used by the UNFFC Secretariat, much of the buildings that the government once occupied are also now used by NGOs. There are actually over 150 different global NGOs headquartered here or with a presence in Bonn, including our guest later on the show, Dolph Heelen, the director of ARENA. But back to the treaty, I've been following some of the progress of the adoption process here on the local level. Though there have been many activist groups helping push this through, it should be said that we already had something of a fossil fuel phase-out pledge on the books here in Bonn, because our aim is already to become entirely climate neutral by 2035. And since our progressive city council and our green mayor or Oberbürgermeisterin Katja Dürner took the helm last year, so to speak, they have been taking steps to achieve these ambitions. Mayor Dürner's endorsement of the global treaty was largely based on its alignment with the pre-existing commitments that the city of Bonn already had. But she did, in a press release, says, and I quote, "One thing is clear, the only way to achieve climate neutrality is through renewable energies and a gradual decarbonization of our energy supply." Now, we've covered the fossil fuel treaty for our first podcast, but that was before COP26 in Glasgow. Sable, could you talk a bit about the initiative's reaction to the COP in Glasgow and tell us how it intends to kick off the new year?
Well, COP was definitely a super exciting time for the treaty. There was, I guess, more and more diverse voices from around the world calling for a treaty. We were able to have the fossil fuel treaty mentioned in over 500 different media articles. And also, Sipora, our chair, put out a TED talk on the need for fossil fuel phase out that's been seen now by more than a million people around the world. We got backing from Fridays for Future and different youth groups around the world calling for a treaty. Also, our partners with Carbon Tracker and Global Energy Monitor began the rollout of the Global Registry of Fossil Fuels, which shows at a country level and at a company level fossil fuel production and reserves, an entirely open access database. And so there's been kind of like growing momentum now. More than 150 parliamentarians from 30 different countries are calling for a fossil fuel free future. So all of this is growing louder and louder as we move into the new year, which has been really exciting. And we want to kind of take that forward into the new year and look towards even garnering support from country governments, et cetera. So we want to keep harnessing this momentum to grow even bigger for 2022.
Just to review, could you tell our audience which other cities and regions have also endorsed the treaty since COP?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a really exciting past few weeks because we obviously had the endorsement from Bonn. We had a couple districts around Vancouver, New Westminster and North Vancouver, and also West Vancouver recently endorsed the call for a fossil fuel treaty. A couple weeks back, we also had seven different municipalities in Costa Rica call for fossil fuel treaty and declared their territories free of oil and gas exploration and extraction. So there's been kind of a lot of momentum growing, and now it's more than 25 and nearing to 30 different cities around the world who are demanding this treaty. And there's different cities that are taking action in different ways. LA, which was the first US city to endorse the treaty, has passed is working towards legislation to ban oil wells so they can stop urban oil drilling. And they also put out a call to be carbon neutral without offsets by the end of the decade. Barcelona has different actions around like solar rooftops and energy efficiency. In Vancouver, which was the first city in the world to back treaty, they're working to reduce their emissions from natural gas in buildings and also from vehicles. So there's concrete action coming from a lot of different places. And we've also developed a fossil fuel free cities toolkit, which has actions that cities can take post-endorsement, because the most common question post-endorsement was what now or what next? And so we created this so that cities can work to kind of remove the social reputation of the fossil fuel industry, which is a lot of what keeps it alive, and kind of treat it in the same way the tobacco industry was socially shunned. And then actions that are concrete to kind of change the infrastructure and the material base of the city to phase out fossil fuels. which I can share with you too, because we want that to grow and grow. But some actions are around, you know, changing electricity grids, retrofitting buildings, banning the sale of vehicles with combustion engines, or around the social license, like banning fossil fuel advertising, which is, you know, going on in Amsterdam and other places, or ending this revolving door between politics and the fossil fuel industry and the fossil free politics campaign. So that we're trying to kind of bring together and support a lot of the movements that are already happening.
There is so much going on and so many ways now that listeners can get involved. We will list many of these in our show notes where listeners can find ways to plug in, maybe even get their hometown or city to endorse. But Sable, this is a global issue, and I mean, act local, think global, or vice versa. But and as we talk here in Bonn, we are, of course, impacted by climate change. You are based in Ethiopia. Can you tell our listeners what is happening there in Ethiopia, in the northeast of Africa, the so-called Horn of Africa? How is the endless extraction of fossil fuels impacting your home region?
Yeah, well, it's mainly a rural people, like a farming culture. I think it's around 80 or 85% of the population is rural. So it depends a lot on farming. It's kind of the backbone of the economy and also of people's livelihoods. And there's been really unpredictable rains. There's been water stress. There's been droughts. There's been a terrible locust invasion in the past years that devastated a lot of the crops. So it's kind of taking away the ability to plan and predict for planting and harvest seasons, which feed the country and feed the most communities who are relying on this for their livelihood. So it's put a lot of instability around a sector that's indispensable for the world, but definitely for Ethiopia. And obviously very troubling to see, because it's a country and a continent that has such minimal impact in terms of the climate crisis globally, both historically and present day. So there's a really strong need to be adapting and building kind of climate resilience around this, because obviously this will continue to be a big part of the country's future, is growing food, as it will be in a lot of countries. So this needs to be kind of a sector that is able to adapt and still kind of be able to grow food, know where to plant, know when to plant, know when to harvest, survive these periods of drought or water stress or flooding. So there's been kind of a lot of changing dynamics, I would say.
Historically, Ethiopia and, well, all the whole continent of Africa has been mined and extracted from, but almost always those fossil fuels and minerals are shipped, used, burned, refined elsewhere. Can you speak more about the ongoing impacts of this imbalance?
Well, I think that dynamic is really important in all of climate justice rhetoric and climate justice campaigns, is to be facing impacts for a crisis that was not caused there. I think it's something around 2 or 3% of the cumulative emissions over time have come from the African continent, but obviously that's disproportionately feeling the impacts. And I think a lot of the discussion now is around having fair phase outs of fossil fuels. So obviously we do have different fossil fuel dependent nations in Africa, such as Nigeria, such as Angola. But while phase out needs to happen here, it also needs to be instigated first in countries like Canada and the US and the UK and Norway need to move a lot faster, because the historical contribution is really different and the economic diversification now is really different and the GDPs are really different. And so there needs to be first a phase out in these kind of northern countries that I've mentioned, so there can be a fair phase out where actually economies in Africa that are depending on fossil fuels can transition in a way where their economies are protected and people's like lives are in, livelihoods are protected. And I just think that's like important to frame in the discussion of how little the continent has contributed to the crisis in the first place. It doesn't protect it from any impacts. It faces really exacerbated negative impacts from the climate crisis. So we think about how that fair phase out needs to happen. It does need to come from the global north first.
While much of Africa's legacy grid is coal dependent, with new development, there's been a real leapfrogging of technologies, at least regionally of late. Could you speak to the growth of decentralized grids and green development there?
Something that's really exciting is that most of the renewable energy potential in the entire world is concentrated in Africa. I think it's around 40%. And so there is kind of the framing that, yes, we're currently living in fossil fuel-based economies around the world, but there's massive potential to kind of electrifies cities and whole countries through renewable energy, through wind, through solar. And there's the most abundant resources are on the African continent. I think that's the most massive potential. We need to think about these possibilities for transition and the fact that a lot of these places don't have kind of these sunken costs into infrastructures that are based in fossil fuel extraction. So that there is that possibility, exactly as you're saying, to leapfrog to abundant and infinite renewable energy sources. And then, yeah, a lot of the reality is that some of these communities, and I'm saying, for example, in Ethiopia, that is a rural society. And so these kind of centralized grids don't often make sense. And there is more need to having remote grids or off the grid kind of electricity access. So there's so much potential for that. We're still seeing kind of like foreign companies still trying to extract resources from the continent. But I think the shift really has to happen. Like there is not that need. We have enough fossil fuels in production currently. What we need to be doing is stopping all new licenses and phasing the current ones out, because we have more than enough renewable energy capacity. And actually, the treaty put out this fossil fuel exit strategy with partners in June, and it shows that we do have more than enough renewable energy capacity to make this transition happen. And I think Africa would be the best place to start, because it is where nearly half of the global potential is located.
What should our audience listen and look for from the fossil fuel treaty campaign in 2022? What's next?
Yeah, we're going to continue growing momentum. We're engaging with parliamentarians, with faith leaders, with young people, with cities. I'm probably missing more constituencies that we're growing with. We want to grow with labor, all of this. So we welcome kind of all these different parts of our communities to reach out and join this call. We want to scale in this new year, pushing for formal endorsements from countries. Stockholm Plus 50 is totally on our radar. It's going to be 50 years since the first conference on the human environment. And obviously, we're looking to COP next year in Egypt, although that is a bit of a ways away. And we have now around 1,000 organizations that are calling for a treaty. We want to continue to grow these. We want to get more endorsements from Nordic cities in the lead up to Stockholm Plus 50 and African cities in the lead up to COP27. So I would just encourage everyone, this is, you know, this a campaign for the world. And so if anyone is interested, we're just so excited to continue growing this, and we want to have a lot more impact this coming year.
And where can our listeners find more information about the campaign?
It's the fossilfueltreaty.org.
And the toolkit, where is that?
Oh, the toolkit is deep in there. I will share that with you. It's called the Fossil Fuel Free Cities Toolkit. I'll share that so you can share with everyone else.
Excellent. Excellent. Like I said earlier, we'll link this into the show notes. We also published a blog a few weeks ago about Bond's endorsement too, where there are also links. Anyway, great work, Sable, and wonderful chatting with you.
You too.
Perhaps, listeners, like me, you find yourself dwelling on how we're actually going to do this. How are we going to move off of polluting fossil fuels and transition to cleaner forms of energy? Well, how to help us get from here to there is kind of the job description of our next guest, Dolph Helin, the director of ARENA's Innovation and Technology Center, which is celebrating its 10th year here in Bonn. Dolph, thanks again for coming on the pod. Could you start out by telling us a little bit about ARENA's mission and the work of the tech center?
Yes, certainly, Michael. ARENA is still a relatively young international agency, so it was only established 10 years ago. And its mandate is to help its member countries to accelerate their renewable energy deployment. And more recently, it has been broadened to help them with their energy transition. And so our members are countries. It has grown from initially 10 years ago, we had 65 members, and now we have about 165 members and another number of countries which are in the process of becoming member. So we have a number of processes ongoing with these countries to provide them with information about renewables, to help them in developing their strategies, and to also increasing to implement these strategies. And we are headquartered in the United Arab Emirates in Abu Dhabi, and our Innovation and Technology Center is in Bonn, and that has also grown over time. So I picked up the key here 10 years ago. And at the moment, we have nearly 100 staff here in Bonn, which are focused on more on the, let's say, the engineering and the economic parts of country support. And that is, there's a lot of interest for that. And it's also very interesting because it's very diverse membership going from small island states to economies the size of China, US, and Europe, which, of course, have very different questions.
We're recording this a few weeks after COP26 in Glasgow concluded, with its watering down the language around coal and some other rather lackluster ambitions. What was your takeaway from COP?
In our view, COP was a significant progress because you may recall the Paris Agreement called for 2 degrees with an effort for 1.5 degrees. And the outcome from Glasgow was really a focus on this 1.5 degree. And half a degree may not sound like a big difference, but it makes an enormous difference in terms of CO2 reduction effort, because it means you require net zero emissions by mid-century. And that means by 2030, you already need to be well advanced on that pathway. So we've moved from a discussion that is decades away to a discussion suddenly of how do we make significant emission reductions in the remaining 9 years to 2030. And then it becomes a very concrete discussion. And there are two main elements in that. One element is we need to decarbonize the power sector, which means especially reducing coal-based power generation and ramping up renewables. And to make that happen, we also need to think about the power system's flexibility options and the enabling frameworks to make that happen. So it's not only about technology, it's also about market design and regulation, it's about operational practices, and it's about the business models. But so that is one part. And the other part is we need to start thinking about decarbonizing the end-use sectors, so buildings, industry, and transport. And there is direct electrification, for example, electromobility as a key solution. And that is, again, of course, we need electric cars, but we also need a recharging infrastructure. We also need a smart recharging infrastructure that can accommodate this variability on the supply side. And we need to think also about what we call the hard to decarbonize sectors, where, for example, green hydrogen produced from renewable electricity can be deployed in certain industries, in shipping or in aviation. We need to make significant progress at least to 2030 to roll that then fully out after 2030.
I definitely want to get more into hydrogen, and we'll get there in a moment. But let's first talk about an ARENA study released in early 2021 showing that solar and wind generation are now by far and away the cheapest forms of energy across the world, both in costs to produce that energy, but also in terms of installing that energy. Yet, that has not stopped many nations from continuing to invest in fossil fuels, particularly fossil gas, even here in the supposedly climate-friendly EU. Why is there this continuing disconnect, and why aren't nearly 100% of new investments just going into renewables?
The transition needs to accelerate significantly. So we need to have more renewable power projects. I think that the annual capacity additions need to increase roughly threefold. And as I outlined, we also need to make all these changes on the demand side. That means we need to develop a lot more projects. And for that, you need to have that project development capacity. You need to get the financing for that going. And also, there's an issue around the manufacturing capacity. I mean, to give you an example, at the moment, we have an annual electrolyzer manufacturing capacity in the order of 2 gigawatts per year worldwide. What we need by 2050 is an installed capacity somewhere between 5,000 and 7,000 gigawatts of electrolyzer capacity. So we need to ramp up that manufacturing capacity massively. And it's the same for electric cars and battery manufacturing. It's the same for offshore wind and other key solutions. So all of that needs to happen now very soon. But at the same time, we need to keep the lights on in this transition. So, and we need to phase out that coal at the same time. You mentioned natural gas, and natural gas is at that interface of the solution. So that's why you see that the opinions about what role has natural gas to play in this transition are very divided.
Staying with fossil gas, what role does ARENA see for green hydrogen replacing fossil methane gas, or for the blending of the two together?
We are looking especially at the role of green gases. So, for example, adding hydrogen or even replacing natural gas fully with hydrogen in gas systems. And there are interesting opportunities in using also biogas and biomethane as a substitute for natural gas. There are certain ways also to avoid the stranding of these important infrastructure assets going forward.
ARENA, like so many other think tanks, has published a lot of studies around hydrogen, what it can do, how it can replace fossil fuels. But so much of the hydrogen used today is made from fossil gas, from methane, and the emissions from this relatively small amount of hydrogen are already huge. The steam methane reformation process is anything but clean. So how does ARENA advise its members on how to prevent the hydrogen shift from taking us backwards?
Hydrogen and clean hydrogen, especially green hydrogen, has come up as a key solution for the transition in just a few years. It's amazing how that attention has grown. We've assisted the governments of Denmark, Germany, and Chile in developing a catalog of hydrogen compacts, green hydrogen compacts, that was launched at the COP. And so these compacts are, let's say, commitments of non-government parties in a certain area. And if you add up all the commitments in that catalog, that adds up to something like 130 gigawatts of electrolyzer capacity. So that is very substantial. And to really deploy that, we need a number of things. We need further cost reductions, both for the renewable power and for the electrolyzers themselves. We need to get to green hydrogen production costs of $1.50 per kilo or even lower. And to do that, we need renewable electricity at 1 or 2 cents per kilowatt hour. And at the same time, we need a low-cost electrolyzer, so a few hundred dollars per kilowatt. We're not yet at these levels yet, but we are confident that we can get to these levels in the coming years through upscaling. But of course, somebody needs to pick up that tab for these early investments. So there's a role for governments to facilitate that, either through investment subsidies, through tax rebates, or through dedicated buying of this more expensive green hydrogen in this initial period. But to get this hydrogen to the consumers, you also need to have the logistics and the infrastructure in place that can be dedicated hydrogen pipelines, that can be refurbished natural gas pipelines, but that can also be long-distance shipping. And for that, you need, of course, ships, but you also need systems in place that guarantee the cleanness and the greenness of that hydrogen. So standards and certification systems become also very important as part of that enabling framework.
What about on the demand side? Where should this hopefully green hydrogen be first deployed?
Some people talk about hydrogen as the champagne of the energy carrier. So it's not a cheap energy carrier. And wherever you can use electricity directly, you should use electricity directly. But there are certain applications where today that is not possible. For example, if you talk about steelmaking, if you talk about ammonia production, a number of other industrial processes, but also the production of clean shipping fuels and clean aviation fuel. So there is a particular role for hydrogen in these applications. And it can also create new business opportunities in locations where that hydrogen is produced. So you may see a new trade emerging of green commodities on the back of green hydrogen.
So do you foresee that areas that are rich in wind and solar resources could boom by being able to attract existing industries and get them to relocate there to take advantage of this green potential?
is certainly one of the factors. So having access to clean, affordable and plentiful energy, I think will be increasingly one of the location factors for these energy intensive industries. And of course, that there are more factors that come into play in location choice than energy, but it is one factor. And you see it, for example, already in the plans for green ammonia production.
What is the ammonia used for, Dolph?
So about 80% of ammonia is going into fertilizer today, and the rest goes into chemicals. But going forward, ammonia can also become an important fuel, for example, in the shipping sector. And the pipeline of green ammonia projects at the moment is roughly equivalent to a quarter of world total ammonia production today.
We have seen historically that industries tend to locate where they have easy access to necessary raw materials, inputs, or even just lots of cheap electricity, say from hydro. Do you see the same thing then happening near term with sectors that want to take advantage of copious amounts of green hydrogen? Do you foresee something of a reverse carbon leakage, a green leakage, where instead of polluting industries in the face of regulations, migrating to areas where they can pollute more freely, do you see a green leakage developing where, say, steel producers will relocate to areas where they can access lots of cheap green hydrogen produced from renewables?
Green leakage is an interesting coinage of such development. I think you will see increasingly green leakage going forward. What makes renewable energy different from fossil fuels is its ubiquitous character. So most places in the world also have significant renewables potential. So it's not a given that it will end up in one country or the other because it's so relatively evenly distributed.
As nations decarbonize their economies, industries are looking to develop and build upon existing technologies. One of these that's kind of crucial are batteries used for electric vehicles and transport. And we are seeing a boom in solar panel production too. This, in turn, is setting off a new mineral rush for lithium, for cobalt, copper, various rare earth minerals and materials like graphite as well. Knowing what we know about past gold and other mineral rushes, as demand for these increase to avoid the worst past practices being repeated, how do you advise countries in the global south and Latin America and Africa elsewhere to protect themselves? What kind of mineral extraction frameworks do you suggest they put in place?
We are at ARENA currently closely looking at the issue of critical materials for the energy transition. And of course, we see that need for the ramp up of supply of certain materials. But you have to put that a little bit into context. I mean, if you take rare earths, for example, worldwide, at the moment, there is only about 11 mines in operation for rare earths. And the amounts that are needed specifically for, say, electric motors and wind turbines is only a small fraction of the total amount of rare earths that is mined. So, of course, that demand will grow significantly going forward, but it's not, let's say, it's a manageable amount that is needed. There's more of a question as we ramp up electromobility towards 2030, will that mining ramp up at the same rate? So normally, development of a mine takes quite some time. And the other, and perhaps more pertinent question, is not so much about the mining, but about the processing of these rare earth elements. So right now, that is very much concentrated in China. And there's now significant efforts also elsewhere to build up that processing capacity. But it's special technology. You need to acquire that technology. And of course, with all these minerals, what you see is that there is strong price fluctuations over time. Would not be surprising if it's the same because of energy transition. And of course, investors are aware of these price fluctuations in the past, and that also is accounted for in the development of new projects. And so that makes for a bit a rocky transition, and there is a role for governments to smooth out these fluctuations, and at the same time to make sure that these mining operations are done in a socially acceptable way, with also benefits for the local populations, with consideration for environment and for other factors.
One of the other technologies that keeps being touted as a solution is carbon capture and sequestration. This is a topic that we've covered a bit on our Energy Transition blog. And when I look at this technology, when I look at projects, I always look at how that carbon is planned to be stored. And since so much of that carbon is used actually for enhanced oil recovery to produce more oil and then more emissions, I have some real reservations about it. But where does IRENA weigh in on CCS?
Personally, I've been involved in CO2 capture assessments, I think, for the last 30 years.
And it's not new.
It's not new. I would say it's technically proven. It's not a cheap technology, and that has been a main obstacle for its widespread deployment so far. So there is something in the order of 50 million tons a year, which is captured and used. And as you said, the bulk is for enhanced oil recovery, which then, of course, creates additional CO2, because that way you create a revenue stream. Because there is now higher CO2 prices, for example, in Europe, there is increased attention also for this solution. But we think that the cost of renewables in power generation have come down so far. But of course, there are certain industry sectors, say cement making, where you may see some deployment of this technology. And we see also a role for biomass in combination with CCS as a way to capture CO2 from the atmosphere through growing trees, and then using the energy from that, and then storing the CO2 underground. But that's then a relatively expensive option that you deploy if you really want to go to these net zero emissions. So we see a role for CCS, but it's clearly smaller than expectations were some time ago.
Over the past 2 years during the pandemic, so much of our focus has changed. What's shifted at IRENA?
We have made a deliberate choice to focus more on the facilitation of implementation. So, for example, that means bringing together project developers and financiers. So to facilitate the deal flow, we've set up a platform for that, climate investment platform. We are more and more working together with the private sector, develop public-private sector initiatives in facilitating transition. I mentioned, for example, this Green Hydrogen Compact is one example, but we were involved in around 20 such compacts for the COP. Together with the World Economic Forum, we've developed this roadmap on enabling measures for accelerating green hydrogen. All of these are examples where, as a relatively small agency, we try to leverage the capacity and the resources of other parties, other stakeholders, to further accelerate this transition. And this is a strategy we want to expand on going forward.
Is there a certain breakthrough technology you are seeing that has captured your imagination that you see taking off near term?
I'm very impressed with the speed which green hydrogen has developed. And you clearly see now that there is momentum towards green commodities on that back. There is, for example, now a lot of attention for what is called e-fuels for aviation. So using green hydrogen in combination with CO2 to make synthetic fuels, the cost reductions are making the and also the change in the policy frameworks are making this increasingly a viable option. And you see now a lot of developments in this area. It's a little bit the same story with shipping, where green ammonia or renewable methanol are now seriously being developed and deployed as low carbon solutions. And of course, this whole trend towards electromobility in the transport sector. So all of this is new. All of this is very exciting. And it offers the prospect also for these hard-to-decarbonize sectors to fully decarbonize by 2050.
In the new year, Dolph, what's on your calendar and what would you like to put on the calendars of our listeners?
A very important event is the next IRENA Assembly. So that will take place from 14 to 16 January in Abu Dhabi, but it will be a hybrid event this time because of the COVID situation. And that is the first major event after COP where the international community will take stock of the outcome and will talk about the next steps in this energy transition. And so the energy transition forum, ministerial forum, will also meet as part of that meeting. And for example, we're also working on a ministerial roundtable on power systems, flexibility, and electrification of end users, where also the new work program for IRENA will be decided, and many of the topics we have discussed about in this discussion will be on the agenda there.
It's been 10 years now since the tech center here in Bonn opened. What are you excited about going forward?
Well, we have a fantastic new building thanks to the support of the German government. But unfortunately, we moved in February last year and we have not yet been able to use that building. So I'm really looking forward to the coming year once this COVID crisis has abated, that we can use this building to the full, that we can use it as a base for international dialogue. And for example, we have our innovation week. We hope that this time we can organize it in person in Bonn, that is has become one of our keynote events, and that we can pick up where we were before this crisis.
Forgive me, I don't know the protocol for when you open up a new building. Do you go ahead and break a bottle of champagne on it the same way you do with a ship?
That was the plan, and the bottle is ready, but we're waiting for the occasion.
Dolph, thanks again for all your efforts and for taking time out to speak with us today.
Thank you very much, Michael. It was a pleasure.
And thanks to all of you who've tuned in and stayed tuned in. Once again, I am your host, Michael Buxbaum, and you have been listening to the Global Energy Transition Podcast, a new series presented by the Heinrich Böll Stiftung European Union and the Global Energy Transition blog. You can follow us on Facebook at global.energy.transition and on Twitter at EnergieWendeGER. You can find me at L. Michael Buxbaum. Thanks again to our guest, Sabol Samland at the Fossil Fuels Treaty and Dolph Helin at IRENA. Please look for links to both of them and to their organizations in our show notes. Thanks also to the Energy Transition team in the EU office in Brussels, Lisa Tostado, Martin Keim, and Joan Lanfranco. Thanks also for your edits and support, Dr. Seuss. And thanks again to the podcast's amazing producer, the sound guru, saxophone champion, and Marvel comic book superhero, Christian Kreienborg. From the former German capital city of Bonn, I wish you all smooth sailing on what may be rough seas ahead. Until next time.